Uncle Hyacinth, Alfred Noyes. One of the best code stories of the First World War centres in the ignominious exploit of the German light cruiser Magdeburg, which, with other ships of the Kaiser's Navy, had been roaming the Baltic, crashing with the British blockade and raiding as far as the Russian coast. On one of these missions, as Fletcher Pratt tells the story in his Secret and Urgent, the Magdeburg went hard aground in a fog and came under the naval guns of the Russians. As the cruiser was being pounded to pieces, the captain apparently ordered the codebooks taken by a small boat some distance from the ship and heaved overboard. This order, for some reason, was not completely carried out, and the code officer instead plunged from the deck of the cruiser itself with the secret volumes in his arms. At the close of the battle, the victorious Russians, with a gesture of chivalry, determined to give the German sailors a formal burial and hauled up those who were lying in the comparatively shallow water surrounding the Magdeburg. One of the officers thus retrieved still bore in his arms the weighted leg covers of the German naval code. Some very serious and determined diving followed, and the code itself was found, damaged by water but still legible. A British destroyer rushed the prize to London, where the British Admiralty, in its Room 40, famous in both fact and fiction, began to work on it. The code was a multiple dictionary type, each German word being represented by not one but several code words or letter groups. It was soon evident, moreover, that although there were several code variants for each German word, these variations were always composed of the same letter groups, although in a different sequence for each variation. For example, the letter groups for German words beginning with B were used in an alternate column to represent words beginning with F, and again for words beginning with S, but the same sequence relationship was always maintained among these letter groups, thus making the decoding of any of these variations much easier. This permitted the Germans to change their code at intervals, and the discovery of the system gave the Allies the same facility in decoding, so that the Germans were disastrously surprised in several naval engagements thereafter. The badly scared Teuton in the following story was obviously not using a top naval code, but the principles of his secret dispatches were much the same. There is also a significant similarity between the German psychology here and in the Second World War. The story, moreover, is one of the few sinister accounts of unrestricted warfare which still manages to include a broad streak of humour. 1. On a bright morning early in the year 1917, Herr Sigismund Krauss, secret agent for the German government, stopped at the entrance of Harrod's stores, looked at himself in one of the big mirrors, thought that he really did look a little like Bismarck, and adjusted his tie. To relieve the tension, let it be added that this scene was not enacted in London, but in the big branch of Harrods that had recently been opened in Buenos Aires. Nevertheless, it was because it looked so very much like the London branch that it had rasped the nerves of Herr Krauss. He was in a very nervous condition, owing to the state of his digestive system, and he was easily irritated. He had been annoyed in the first place because the German houses in Buenos Aires were unable to sell him several things which he thought necessary for the voyage he was about to take across the Atlantic. He had been almost angry when the bald-headed Englishman who had waited on him in Harrods advised him to buy a safety waistcoat. All that he needed for his safety was the fraudulent Swedish passport made out in the name of Erik Nielsen, which he carried in his breast pocket. "I am an American citizen," he said, complicating matters still further. "I am sailing to Barcelona on an Argentine ship, which the Germans are pledged not to sink." "This is the exact model of the waistcoat that saved the life of Lord Winchelsea," said the Englishman. "I advise you to procure one. You never know what those damn Germans will do." It was a chance of raising a little feeling against the United States, and Herr Krauss never lost an opportunity. He pretended to be even more angry than he really was. "That is a most uncalled-for suggestion to a citizen of a neutral country," he snorted. "I shall report it to the authorities." These mixed emotions had disarranged his tie, but he had obtained all that he wanted, and when he emerged into the street, the magic of the blue sky and the brilliance of the sunlight on the stream of motor cars and gay dresses cheered him greatly. After all, it was not at all like London, and there were still places where a good German might speak his mind if he did not insist too much on his allegiance. He was in a great hurry, for his ship, the Hispaniola, sailed that afternoon. When he reached his hotel, he had only just time enough to pack his hand luggage and drive down to the docks. His trunk had gone down in advance. It was very important indeed that he should not miss the boat. There was trouble pending, which might lead to his arrest if he remained in Argentina for another week, and there was urgent and profitable work for him to do in Europe. In his cab on the way to the docks, he examined the three letters which had been waiting for him at the hotel. Two of them were requests for a settlement of certain bills. They can wait, he murmured to himself euphemistically, till after the war. The third letter ran thus. Dear Eric, bon voyage, most amusing news, operation successful, Uncle Hyacinth's appetite splendid, 6 meals daily, yours affectionately, Bolo. This was the most annoying thing of all. Herr Kraus knew nothing about any operation. He knew even less about Uncle Hyacinth, and in order to interpret the message he would require the code, number 6 as indicated by the last word but 2, and the code was locked up in his big brass-bound steamer trunk. It was not likely to be anything that required immediate attention. He had received a number of code messages lately which did not even call for a reply. It was merely irritating. When he reached the docks, he found that his trunk was buried under a mountain of other baggage on the lower deck of the Hispaniola, and that he would not be able to get at it before they sailed. He had just 10 minutes to dash ashore and ring up the German legation on the telephone. He wasted nearly all of them in getting the right change to slip into the machine. A most exasperating conversation followed.
I wish to speak to the German minister.
He is away for the weekend. This is his secretary.
This is Sigismund Kraus speaking?
Oh, yes. I have received a message about Uncle Hyacinth. I can't hear.
Uncle Hyacinth's appetite!
This was bellowed.
Oh, yes.
The voice was very cautious and polite.
I want to know if it's important.
Whose appetite did you say?
Uncle Hyacinth's!
This was like Hindenburg himself thundering. There seemed to be some sort of consultation at the other end of the wire. Then the reply came very clearly.
I'm sorry, but we cannot talk over the telephone. I can't hear anything you say. Please put your question in writing.
It was an obvious lie for anyone to say he could not hear the tremendous voice in which Herr Kraus had made his touching inquiry, but he fully understood the need for caution. He had tapped too many wires himself to blame his colleagues for timidity. He had only a minute to burst out of the telephone booth and regain the deck before the gangplanks were hoisted in and the ship began to slide away to the open sea. He was more than annoyed, he was disgusted, to find that half the people on board were talking English. Two or three of them, including the captain, were actually British subjects, while the purser, a few of the stewards and several passengers were citizens of the United States. It was late that evening, and the shore lights had all died away over the pitch-black water, when the brass-bound trunk belonging to Mr. Nielsen, as we must call him henceforward, was carried into his stateroom by two grunting stewards. The mysterious letter could be of no use to the fatherland now, and he certainly did not expect it to be important from a selfish point of view. Also, he was hungry, and he did not hurry over his dinner in order to decode it. It was only his curiosity that impelled him to do so before he turned in. But a kind of petrification overspread his well-fed countenance as the significance of the message dawned upon him. He sat on a suitcase in his somewhat cramped quarters and translated it methodically, looking up the meaning of each word in the code like a very unpleasant schoolboy with a dictionary. He was nothing if not efficient, and he wrote it all down in pencil on a sheet of notepaper in two parallel columns, thus, Bon voyage, U-boats, most, instructed. Amusing, sink, news, Argentine, operation, ships, successful, destruction, Uncle Hyacinth's, Hispaniola, appetite, essential, splendid, cancel, 6, code number, meals, passage, daily, immediately. Perhaps to make sure that his eyes did not deceive him, Mr. Nielsen wrote the translation out again mechanically in its proper form at the foot of the page, thus, U-boats instructed sink Argentine ships. Destruction Hispaniola essential. Cancel passage immediately. It seemed to have exactly the same meaning. It was ghastly. He knew exactly what that word destruction meant as applied to the Hispaniola. He had been present at a secret meeting only a month ago, at which it was definitely decided that it would be inadvisable to carry out a certain amiable plan of sinking the Argentine ships without leaving any traces while an appearance of friendship was maintained with the Argentine government. Evidently, this policy had suddenly been reversed.
there would be a concentration of half a dozen U-boats, a swarm of them probably, for the express purpose of sinking the Hispaniola, just as they had concentrated on the Lusitania. But in this case, there would be no survivors at all. The ship's boats would be destroyed by gunfire with all their occupants, because it was necessary that there should be no evidence of what had happened, and necessity knows no law. There was no chance of their failing. They would not dare to fail, and he himself would organize the system by which the most precise information with regard to sailings was conveyed to the German Admiralty. He crushed all the papers into his breast pocket and hurried up on deck. It was horribly dark. At the smoking room door, he met one of the ship's officers.
"Tell me," said Mr. Nielsen, "is there any possibility of our meeting a ship bound the other way?"
The officer stared at him, wondering whether Mr. Nielsen was drunk or seasick. "Certainly," he said, "but it's not likely for some days on this course."
"Will it be possible for me to be taken off and return? I have found among my mail an important letter. A friend is very ill."
"I'm afraid it's quite impossible. In the first place, we are not likely to meet anything but cattle ships till we are in European waters."
"Oh, but in this case, even a cattle ship," said Mr. Nielsen with great feeling.
"It is impossible, I am afraid. In any case, it is absolutely against the rules, and in wartime, of course, they are more strict than ever."
"Even if I were to pay?"
"Time is not for sale in this war, unfortunately. It's verboten," said the officer with a smile, and that, of course, Mr. Nielsen understood at once. He was naturally an excitable man, and his inability to obtain his wish made him feel that he would give all his worldly possessions at this moment for a berth in the dirtiest cattle boat that ever tramped the seas, if only it were going in the opposite direction. He returned to his stateroom almost panic-stricken. He sat down on the suitcase and held his head between his hands while he tried to think. He was a slippery creature, and his fellow countrymen had often admired his slimness in former crises, but it was difficult to discover a cranny big enough for a cockroach here, unless he made a clean breast of it to the captain. In that case, he would be incriminated with all the belligerents and most of the neutrals. There would be no place in the world where he could hide his head, except perhaps Mexico. He would probably be penniless as well. At this point in his cogitations, there was a knock on the door, which startled him like a pistol shot. He opened it a cautious inch or two, for his papers were all over his berth, and a steward handed him a telegram.
"This was waiting for you at the purser's office, sir," he said. "The mail has only just been sorted. If you wish to reply by wireless, you can do so up to midnight."
The man was smiling as if he knew the contents. There had been some jesting, in fact, about this telegram at the office. A gleam of hope shot through Mr. Nielsen's chaotic brain as he opened the envelope with trembling fingers. Perhaps it contained reassuring news. His face fell. It simply repeated the former sickening message about Uncle Hyacinth, but the steward had reminded him of one last resource.
"Yes," he said, trying hard to be calm. "I shall want to send a reply."
"Here is a form, sir. You'll find the regulations printed on the back." Mr. Nielsen closed the door and sank, gasping, on the suitcase to examine the form. The regulations stated that no message would be accepted in code. This did not worry him at first, as he thought he could concoct an apparently straightforward and harmless message with the elaborate vocabulary of his number 6. But the code had not been intended for agonizing moments like these. It abounded in commercial phrases, medical terms, and domestic greetings, and though there were a number of alternative words and synonyms, it was not so easy as he had expected to make a coherent message which should be apparently a reply to the telegram he had received. After half an hour of seeking for the mot juste which would have melted the heart of a Flaubert, he arrived at the purser's office with wild eyes and handed in the yellow form.
"I wish to send this by Marconi wireless," he said.
The purser tapped each word with his pencil as he read it over. "Splendid, stop, most amusing, stop, use heaps, butter, stop, congratulate Uncle Hyacinth, stop, love, stop, Eric, stop."
"I beg your pardon, sir," said the purser, "but we can only accept messages en clair." "It is as clear as I can make it," said Mr. Nielsen, and he was telling the truth. "It is the answer to the telegram which was handed to me on board." "It looks a little unusual, sir." "It is connected with an unusual operation," said Mr. Nielsen, who was getting thoroughly rattled, "and concerns the diet of the patient."
The steward departed on his errand.
Captain Abbey took another sheet of paper and laboriously, with tongue out thrust, constructed a sentence, consulting the purser's two columns from time to time and occasionally chuckling as he altered or added a word. The purser slapped his thighs with delight as he followed the work over the captain's shoulder, and when the form arrived, he wrote out the captain's composition in a very large, clear hand with the fervour of a man announcing good news. Then he licked the flap of the yellow envelope, closed it, addressed it, and handed it to the steward.
"Give this wireless message to Mr. Nielsen in half an hour. Tell him it has just arrived. If there is any reply tonight, he must send it before 12 o'clock.
"I hope that will make him sit up and think," said Captain Abbey. "I'll consider what steps I'd better take to save the ship, and then I shall probably have a wireless or two of my own to send elsewhere."
Mr. Nielsen was greatly excited when the steward knocked at his door and handed him the second wireless message. He opened it with trembling fingers and read, "Still more successful? Stop. Uncle Hyacinth's tonsils removed? Stop. Appetite now colossal? Stop. Bless him? Stop. Taking large quantities frozen meat? Stop." He could hardly wait to translate it. He sat down on his suitcase again and spelled it out with the help of his number 6, word by word, refusing to believe his eyes, refusing even to read it as a consecutive sentence till the bottom of the two parallel columns had been reached, thus: "Still, impossible, more, total, successful, destruction, Uncle Hyacinth's, Hispaniola, tonsils, von Tirpitz, removed, advises, appetite, essential, now, squadron, colossal, 20, bless him, submarines, taking, waiting, large, appropriate, quantities, death, frozen, good, meat, German, best, enviable, greetings, position." This was hideous. He remembered all that he had done all over the world in the interests of the fatherland. He remembered the skillful way in which, long before the war, he had stirred up feeling in America against Japan, and in Japan against both America and England. He remembered the way in which he had manipulated the peace societies in the interest of militarism. He had spent several years in London before the war, and he believed he had helped to make the very name of England a reproach in literary coteries, so that current English literature, unless it went far beyond honest criticism of English life, unless indeed it manifested a complete contempt for that pharisaical country and painted it as rotten from head to foot, lost caste among the self-enthroned British intellectuals. It was very easy to do this, because though English editors paid considerable attention to their leading articles, some of them did not care very much what kind of stuff was printed in their literary columns, and they would allow the best of our literature, old and new, and the most representative part of it, to be misrepresented by an anonymous Sinn Féiner in half a dozen journals simultaneously. The editors were patriotic enough, but they didn't think current literature of much importance. He had been able, therefore, to quote extracts from important journals in the foreign press. He had been helped, too, by lecturers who drew pensions from the British government for their literary merits, and told American audiences that the one flag they loathed was the flag of the land that pensioned them. He had reprinted these utterances, together with the innocent bleatings of the intellectuals, and scattered them all over the world in pamphlet form. He had marked passages in their books and sent them to friends. Thousands of columns were devoted to them in the newspapers of foreign countries, while the English press occasionally referred to them in brief paragraphs, announcing to a drugged public at home that the vagaries of these writers were of no importance. He had carried out the program of his country to the letter and poisoned the intellectual wellsprings. No grain of poison was too small. He had even written letters to the newspapers in Scotland, which had stimulated the belief of certain zealous Scots that whenever the name of England was used, it was intended as a deliberate onslaught upon the Union. There was hardly any destructive force or thought or feeling, good, bad, or merely trivial, which he had not turned to the advantage of Germany and the disadvantage of other nations. Then, when the war broke out, he had redoubled his activities. He was amazed when he thought of the successful lies he had fostered all over the world. He had plotted with Hindus on the coast of California and provided them with the literature of freedom in the interests of autocracy. He worked for dissension abroad and union in Germany. He was hand in glove with the IWW. He was idealist, socialist, pacifist, anarchist, futurist, suffragist, nationalist, internationalist, and always publicist, all at once and for one cause only, the cause of Germany. And this was the gratitude of the swine? Well, he would teach them a lesson. God in heaven, there was only one thing he could do to save his skin. He would send them an ultimatum. It was their last chance. He shivered to think that it might be his own. but it was not so easy as he thought it would be to burn all his boats. It cost him 2 days and 2 nights of torturous thinking before he could bring himself to the point. At 11 o'clock on the third night, the purser brought the captain a new message, which Mr. Nielsen had just handed in to be dispatched by wireless. It ran as follows. Continue treatment, stop. Vastly amusing, stop. Uncle Hyacinth's magnificent constitution, stand anything, stop. Apply mustard, stop. Try red pepper, stop. The group that met to consider this new development included 3 passengers whom the captain had invited to share what he called the fun. They were a Mr. Pugh, an American girl who was going to Europe to do Red Cross work, and a Mr. and Mrs. Pennyfeather, English residents of Buenos Aires, with whom she was travelling. The message, as they interpreted it, ran as follows. Unless instructions to sink Hispaniola countermanded, shall inform captain. No alternative. Most important papers my possession.
Good, said Captain Abbey. He's beginning to show symptoms of blackmail. I'd send this message on, only we're likely to make a bigger bag by keeping quiet. We'll let him have the reply tomorrow morning. What shall we do to him next?
Shoot him, said Mr. Pugh with complete calm.
Oh, I want to have a little fun with him first, said Captain Abbey. I'm afraid you haven't got much sense of humour, Mr. Pugh.
Do you think so? She said.
She was the purest Gibson type, and never flickered an innocent eyelash or twisted a corner of her red cupid's bow of a mouth as she drawled,
I think it would be very humorous indeed to shoot him, now that we know he is a German.
Well, after his trying to leave us without warning, he deserves to be skinned and stuffed, but we're likely to make much more of it if we keep him alive for our entertainment. Beside, he's going to be useful on the other side. Now, what do you think of this for a scheme?
The heads of the conspirators drew closer round the table, and Mr. Nielsen, wandering on deck like a lost spirit, pondered on the tragic ironies of life. The thoughtless laughter that rippled up to him from the captain's cabin filled him with no compassion toward anyone but himself. It was merely one more proof that only the Germans took life seriously. All the same, if he could possibly help it, he was not going to let them take his own life. 2. There was no radiogram for Mr. Nielsen on the following day, and he was perplexed by a new problem as he walked feverishly up and down the promenade deck. Even if he received an assurance that the Hispaniola would be spared, how could he know that he was being told the truth? Necessity, as he knew quite well, was the mother of murder. It was very necessary indeed that his mouth should be sealed. Besides, he had more than a suspicion that his use was fulfilled in the eyes of the German government, that they would not be sorry if they could conveniently get rid of him. He possessed a lot of perilous knowledge, and he wished heartily that he didn't. He was tasting, in fact, the inevitable hell of the criminal, which is not that other people distrust him, but that he can trust nobody else. He leaned over the side of the ship and watched the white foam veining the black water.
Curious, isn't it?
Said dapper little Mr. Pennyfeather, who stood near him.
Exactly like liquid marble. Makes you think of that philosophic Johnny, what's his name, fellow that says everything flows, don't you know? And it does, too, by Jove, everything, including one's income. It's curious, Mr. Nielsen, how quickly we've changed all our ideas about the value of human life, isn't it? By Jove, that's flowing too. The other morning I caught myself saying that there was no news in the paper, and then I realized that I'd overlooked the sudden death of about 10,000 men on the Western Front. Well, we've all got to die some day, and perhaps it's best to do it before we deteriorate too far. Don't you think so?
Mr. Nielsen grunted morosely. He hated to be pestered by these gadflies of the steamer. He particularly disliked this little Englishman with the neat grey beard, not only because he was the head of an obnoxious bank in Buenos Aires, but because he would persist in talking to him with a ghoulish geniality about submarine operations and the subject of death. Also, he was one of those hopeless people who had been led by the wholesale slaughter of the war to thoughts of the possibility of a future life. Apparently, Mr. Pennyfeather had no philosophy, and his spiritual being was groping for light through those materialistic fogs which brood over the borderlands of science. His wife was even more irritating, for she too was groping, chiefly because of the fashion, and they both insisted on talking to Mr. Nielsen about it. They quite spoiled his breakfast this morning. He did not resent it on spiritual grounds, for he had none. But he did resent it because it reminded him of his mortality, and also because a professional quack does not like to be bothered by amateurs. Mrs. Pennyfeather approached him now on the other side. She was a faded lady with hair dyed yellow and tortoiseshell spectacles.
"Have you ever had your halo red, Mr. Nielsen?"
she asked with a sickly smile.
"No, I don't believe in it," he said gruffly.
"But surely you believe in the spectrum," she continued, with a ghastly inconsequence that almost curdled the logic in his German brain.
"Certainly," he replied, trying hard to be polite.
"And therefore inspectors," she cooed ingratiatingly, as if she were talking to a very small child.
"Not at all, not at all," he exploded somewhat violently, while Mr. Pennyfeather on the other side came to his rescue, sagely repudiating the methods of his wife.
"No, no, my dear, I don't think your train of thought is quite correct there. My wife and I are very much interested in recent occult experiments, Mr. Nielsen. We've been wondering whether you wouldn't join us one night round the Ouija board."
"It is all nonsense to me," said Mr. Nielsen, gesticulating with both arms.
"Quite so, very natural. But we got some very curious results last night," continued Mr. Pennyfeather. "Most extraordinary. The purser was with us and he thought it would interest you. I wish you would join us."
"I should regard it as complete waste of time," said Mr. Nielsen.
"Surely nothing can be waste of time that increases our knowledge of the bourne from which no traveller returns," replied the lyric lips of Mrs. Pennyfeather.
"To me the methods are ridiculous," said Mr. Nielsen. "All this furniture removal, ach!"
"Ah," said Mr. Pennyfeather, "you should read what's-his-name. You know the chap, Susan. Fellow that said it's like a shipwrecked man waving a shirt on a stick to attract attention. Of course it's ridiculous, but what else can you do if you haven't any other way of signalling? Why, man alive, you'd use your trousers, wouldn't you, if you hadn't anything else? And the alternative, drowning, remember? Drowning beneath what Thingum Bob calls the unplumbed salt estranging sea."
"Excuse me," said Mr. Nielsen. "I have some important business with the captain. I must go."
Mr. Nielsen had been trying hard to make up his mind, despite these irrelevant interruptions. He had received no assurance by wireless, and he had convinced himself that even if he did receive one, it would be wiser to inform the captain. But there were many difficulties in the way. He had taken great care never to do anything that might lead to the death penalty, that is to say, among nations less civilized than his own. But there was that affair of the code. It might make things very unpleasant. A dozen other suspicious circumstances would have to be explained away. A dozen times he had hesitated, as he did this morning. He met the captain at the foot of the bridge.
"Ah, Mr. Nielsen," said Captain Abbey with great cordiality, "you're the very man I want to see. We're having a little concert tonight in the first-class dining room on behalf of the wives and children of the British minesweepers and the auxiliary patrols. You see, though this is a neutral ship, we depend upon them more or less for our safety. I thought it would be pleasant if you, as a neutral, would just say a few words. I understand that they've rescued a good many Swedish crews from torpedoed ships, and whatever view we may take of the war, we have to admit that these little boats are doing the work of civilization."
Mr. Nielsen thought he saw an opportunity of ingratiating himself, and he seized it. He could broach the other matter later on.
"I will do my best, Captain. Here is a London newspaper that will tell you all about their work."
Mr. Nielsen retired to his stateroom and studied the newspaper fervently. The captain took the chair that evening, and he did it very well. He introduced Mr. Nielsen in a few appropriate words, and Mr. Nielsen spoke for nearly 5 minutes in English with impassioned eloquence and a rapidly deteriorating accent.
"These are little patrol boats," he said in his peroration, "out touching to the art is their work. Some of us forget when we are safe on the land and how much we owe to them. But no matter what your nationality, when you are on the high seas, surrounded with darkness and dangers, not knowing when you shall be torpedoed, what a great affection you feel then to these little patrol boats. As a citizen of Sweden, I speak what I know. The ships of my country have suffered much in this war. The sailors of my country have been thrown into the water by thousands through their submarines. But these are little patrol boats. They save them from drowning. They give them blankets and hot coffee. They restore them to their weeping mothers."
Mr. Nielsen closed amid tumultuous applause, and when the collection was taken up by Mr. Pugh, his contribution was the largest of the evening. The rest of the entertainment consisted chiefly of music and recitation. Mr. Pennyfeather contributed a song composed by himself. Typewritten copies of the words were issued to the audience, and a very fat and solemn Spaniard accompanied him with thunderous chords on the piano. Everyone joined in the chorus, but Mr. Nielsen did not like the song at all. It was concerned with Mr. Pennyfeather's usual gruesome subject, and he rolled it out in a surprisingly rich baritone with the gusto of a schoolboy. "If they sink us, we shall be all the nearer to the sea. There's no hardship to deplore. We've all been in the sea before." Chorus. "And then we'll go a-rambling, a-rambling, a-rambling with all the little lobsters from Frisco to the Nore."
If we swim, it's one more tale, round the hearth and over the ale. When your lass is on your knee, and love comes laughing from the sea. Chorus, and then we'll all go a-rambling, 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 a-rambling through the roses that ramble round the door. If we drown, our bones and blood mingle with the eternal flood. That's not hardship to deplore, we've all been in the sea before. Chorus, and then we'll go a-rambling, 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 the road that Jonah rambled and 20,000 more.
Now, said Mr. Pennyfeather, holding out his hands like the conductor of a revival meeting, all the ladies very softly, please.
The solemn Spaniard rolled his great black eyes at the audience and repeated the refrain pianissimo while the silvery voices carolled,
with all the little lobsters from Frisco to the Nore.
Now all the gentlemen, please, said Mr. Pennyfeather. The Spaniard's eyes flashed. He rolled thunder from the piano, and Mr. Nielsen found himself bellowing with the rest of the audience. The road that Jonah rambled from Hull to Singapore, and 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000, 60,000, 70,000, 80,000 more. It was an elaborate conclusion, accompanied by elephantine stampings of Captain Abbey's feet. But Mr. Nielsen retired to his room in a state of great depression. The frivolity of these people in the face of his countrymen appalled him. On the next morning, he decided to act and sent a message to the captain asking for an interview. The captain responded at once and received him with great cordiality. But the innocence of his countenance almost paralyzed Mr. Nielsen's intellect at the outset, and it was very difficult to approach the subject.
"Do you see this, Mr. Nielsen?" said the captain, holding up a large champagne bottle. "Do you know what I've got in this?"
"Champagne," said Mr. Nielsen with the weary pathos of a logician among idiots.
"No, sir. Guess again."
"Pilsner."
"No, sir. It's plain seawater. I've just filled it. I'm taking it home to my wife. She takes it for the good of her stomach, a small wine glass at a time. She always likes me to fill it for her in mid-Atlantic. She's come to depend on it now, and I wouldn't dare to go home without it. I forgot to fill it once till we were off the coast of Spain, and would you believe it, Mr. Nielsen, that woman knew. The moment she tasted it, she knew it wasn't the right vintage. Well, sir, we shall soon be in the war zone now, but you are not looking very well, Mr. Nielsen. I hope you've got a comfortable room."
"I have reason to believe, Captain, that there will be an attempt made by the submarines to sink the Hispaniola," said Mr. Nielsen abruptly.
"Nonsense, my dear sir. This is a neutral ship, and we're sailing to a neutral country, under explicit guarantees from the German government. They won't sink the Hispaniola for the pleasure of killing her superannuated English captain."
"I have reason to believe they intend to, change their policy. I was not sure of it till I opened my mail on the boat, but, I have a friend in Buenos Aires who was in close touch, business connections, with members of the German legation. He, advised me too late I had better cancel my passage. I fear there is no doubt they will change their policy."
"But they couldn't. There ain't any policy. The Argentine Republic is a neutral country. You can't make me believe they'd do a thing like that. It wouldn't be honest, Mr. Nielsen. Of course, it's wartime, but the German government wants to be honourable, don't it, like any other government?"
"I don't understand the reasons, but I fear there is no doubt about the facts," said Mr. Nielsen.
"Have you got the letter?"
"No, I thought as you do at first, and I tore it up."
"Was that why you wanted to get off and go back?"
the captain inquired mercilessly.
"I confess I was a little alarmed, but I thought perhaps I was unduly alarmed at the time. I couldn't trust my own judgment, and I had no right to make other passengers nervous."
"That was very thoughtful of you. I trust you will continue to keep this matter to yourself, for I assure you, though I consider the German government hopelessly wrong in this war, they wouldn't do a dirty thing like that. They're very anxious to be on good terms with the South American republics, and they'd ruin themselves forever."
"But my information is that they will sink the ship without leaving any traces."
"What do you mean? Pretend to be friendly and then come on now. That's an awful suggestion to make." At these words, Mr. Nielsen had a vivid mental picture of his conversation with the bald-headed Englishman in Harrods.
"Do you mean," the captain continued, waxing eloquent, "do you mean they'd sink the ships and massacre every blessed soul aboard regardless of their nationality? Of course, I'm an Englishman and I don't love 'em, but that ain't even murder. That's plain beastliness. It couldn't be done by anything that walks on two legs. I tell you what, Mr. Nielsen, you're a bit overwrought and nervous. You want a little recreation. You better join the party tonight in my cabin. Mr. and Mrs. Pennyfeather are coming, and a very nice American girl, Mr. Pugh. We're going to get a wireless message or two from the next world. Ever played with the Ouija board? Nor had I till this voyage, but I must say it's interesting. You ought to see it as a scientific man. I understand you're interested in science, and you know there's no end of scientists. Big men too taking this thing up. You better come. 8:30. Right you are.
And so Mr. Nielsen was ushered out into despair for the rest of the day and booked for an unpleasant evening. He'd accepted the captain's invitation as a matter of policy, for he thought he might be able to talk further with him, and it was not always easy to secure an opportunity. In fact, when he thought things over, he was inclined to feel more amiably toward the Pennyfeathers, who had put the idea of psychical research into the captain's head. Promptly at 8:30, therefore, he joined the little party in the captain's cabin. Mr. Pugh looked more Gibsonish than ever, and she smiled at him bewitchingly, with a smile as hard and brilliant as diamonds. Mrs. Pennyfeather looked like a large artificial chrysanthemum, and she examined his black tie and dinner jacket with the wickedly observant eye of a cockatoo. 3 times in the first 5 minutes she made his hand travel over his shirt front to find out which stud had broken loose. They had driven him nearly mad in his stateroom that evening, and he had turned his trunk inside out in the process of dressing to find some socks. Moreover, he had left his door unlocked. He was growing reckless. Perhaps the high sentiments of everyone on board had made him trustful. If he had seen the purser exploring the room and poking under his berth, he might have felt uneasy, for that was what the purser was doing at this moment. Mr. Nielsen might have been even more mystified if he had seen the strange objects which the purser had laid for the moment on his pillow. One of them looked singularly like a rocket, of the kind ships use for signalling purposes. But Mr. Nielsen could not see, and so he was only worried by the people round him. Captain Abbey seemed to have washed his face in the sunset. He was larger and more like a marine, weller than ever in his best blue and gilt, and Mr. Pennyfeather was just dapper little Mr. Pennyfeather with his beard freshly brushed.
"You've never been in London, Mr. Pugh,"
said Captain Abbey reproachfully while the Pennyfeathers prepared the Ouija board.
"Ah, but you ought to see the Thames at Westminster Bridge. No doubt the Amazon and the Mississippi, considered as rivers, are all right in their way. They're 10 times bigger than our smoky old river at home. But the Thames is more than a river, Mr. Pugh. The Thames is liquid history."
As soon as the Ouija board was ready, they began their experiment. Mr. Nielsen thought he had never known anything more sickeningly illustrative of the inferiority of all intellects to the German. He tried the Ouija board with Mrs. Pennyfeather, and the accursed thing scrawled one insane syllable. It looked like cows, but Mr. Pugh decided that it was crows. Then Mrs. Pennyfeather tried it with Captain Abbey, and they got nothing at all, except an occasional giggle from the lady to the effect that she didn't think the captain could be making his mind a blank. Then Mr. Pennyfeather tried it with Mr. Pugh, with no result but the obvious delight of that sprightly middle-aged gentleman at touching her polished fingertips and the long, uneven line that was driven across the paper by the ardour of his pressure. Finally, Mr. Pugh, subduing the glint of her smile slightly, a change as from diamonds to rubies, but hard and clear-cut as ever, declared, on the strength of Mr. Nielsen's first attempt, that he seemed to be the most sensitive of the party, and she would like to try it with him. Strangely enough, Mr. Nielsen felt a little mollified, even a little flattered by the suggestion. He was quite ready to touch the fingertips of Mr. Pugh and try again. She had a small hand. He could not help remembering the legend that after the Creator had made the rosy fingers of the first woman, the devil had added those tiny, gem-like nails. But he thought the devil had done his work in this case like an expert jeweler. Mr. Nielsen was always ready to bow before efficiency, even if its weapons were no more imposing than a manicure set. The Ouija board was quiet for a moment or two. Then the pencil began to move across the paper. Mr. Nielsen did not understand why. Mr. Pugh certainly looked quite blank, and the movement seemed to be independent of their own consciousness. It was making marks on the paper, and that was all he expected it to do. At last, Mr. Pugh withdrew her hand and exclaimed,
"It's too exhausting. Read it, somebody."
Mr. Pennyfeather picked it up and laughed.
"Looks to me as if the spirits are a bit erratic tonight, but the writing's clear enough in a scrawly kind of way. I'm afraid it's utter nonsense."
He began to read it aloud.
"Exquisitely amusing. Uncle Hyacinth's little appendix."
At this moment he was interrupted.
Mr. Nielsen had risen to his feet as if he were being hauled up by an invisible rope attached to his neck. His movement was so startling that Mrs. Pennyfeather emitted a faint, mouse-like screech. They all stared at him, waiting to see what he would do next. But Mr. Nielsen recovered himself with great presence of mind. He drew a handkerchief from his trousers pocket, as if he had only risen for that purpose. Then he sat down again.
"Pardon me," he said. "I thought I was about to sneeze. What is the rest of it?"
He sat very still now, but his mouth opened and shut dumbly like the mouth of a fish, while Mr. Pennyfeather read the message through to the end.
"Exquisitely amusing. Uncle Hyacinth's little appendix cut out, throat enlarged, consuming immense quantities pork sausages, also onions wholesale. Best greetings. Fond love. Kisses."
"I'm afraid they're playing tricks on us tonight," said Mr. Pennyfeather.
"They do sometimes, you know, or it may be fragments of two or three messages which have got mixed."
"Hold on, though," said the captain. "Didn't you send a wireless the other day, Mr. Nielsen, to somebody by the name of Hyacinth?" "Well, it was about somebody by that name. I suppose I must have moved my hand unconsciously. I've been thinking about him a great deal. He's ill, you see."
"How very interesting," cooed Mrs. Pennyfeather, drawing her chair closer. "Have you really an uncle named Hyacinth? Such a pretty name for an elderly gentleman, isn't it? Doesn't the rest of the message mean anything to you, then, Mr. Nielsen?"
He stared at her, and then he stared at the message, licking his lips. Then he stared at Captain Abbey and Mr. Pugh. He could read nothing in their faces but the most childlike amusement. The thing that chilled his heart was the phrase about onions. He could not remember the meaning, but it looked like one of those innocent commercial phrases that had been embodied in the code. Was it possible that in his agitation he had unconsciously written this thing down? He crumpled up the paper and thrust it into his side pocket. Then he sniggered mirthlessly. Greatly to his relief, the captain began talking to Mr. Pugh as if nothing had happened about the Tower of London, and he was able to slip away before they brought the subject down to modern times. 3. Mr. Nielsen may have been a very sceptical person. Perhaps his intellect was really paralyzed by panic, for the first thing he did on reaching his stateroom that night was to get out the code and translate the message of the Ouija board. It was impossible that it should mean anything, but he was impelled by something stronger than his reason. He broke into a cold sweat when he discovered that it had as definite a meaning as any of the preceding messages, and though it was not the kind of thing that would have been sent by wireless, he recognized that it was probably far nearer the truth than any of them. This is how he translated it. "Imperative sink Hispaniola after treacherous threat. Wiser sacrifice life. Otherwise, death penalty inevitable. Flight abroad futile, enviable position, fine opportunity, hero." He could not understand how this thing had happened. Was it possible that in great crises an agitated mind 2,000 miles away might create a corresponding disturbance in another mind which was concentrated on the same problem? Had he evolved these phrases of the code out of some subconscious memory and formed them into an intelligible sentence? Trickery was the only other alternative, and that was out of the question. All these people were of inferior intellect. Besides, they were in the same peril themselves and obviously ignorant of it. His code had never been out of his possession, yet he felt as if he had been under the microscope. What did it mean? He felt as if he were going mad. He crept into his berth in a dazed and blundering way, like a fly that just crawled out of a honey pot. After an hour of feverish tossing from side to side, he sank into a doze, only to dream of the bald-headed man in Harrods who wanted to sell him a safety waistcoat, the exact model of the one that saved Lord Winchelsea. The most hideous series of nightmares followed. He dreamed that the sides of the ship were transparent and that he saw the periscopes of innumerable submarines foaming alongside through the black water. He could not cry out, though he was the only soul aboard that saw them, for his mouth seemed to be fastened with official sealing wax, black sealing wax, stamped with the German eagle. Then to his horror, he saw the quick phosphorescent lines of 12 torpedoes darting toward the Hispaniola from all points of the compass. A moment later, there was an explosion that made him leap, gasping and fighting for breath out of his berth. But this was not a dream. It was the most awful explosion he had ever heard, and his room stank of sulfur. He seized the cork jacket that hung on his wall, pulled his door open and rushed out, trying to fasten it round him as he went. When the steward arrived with the purser, they had the stateroom to themselves, and after the former had thrown the remains of the rocket through the porthole, together with the ingenious contrivance that had prevented it from doing any real damage under Mr. Nielsen's berth, the purser helped him with his own hands to carry the brass-bound trunk down to his office.
"We'll tell him that his room was on fire and we had to throw the contents overboard. We'll give him another room and a suit of old clothes for tomorrow. Then we can examine his possessions at leisure. We've got the code now, but there may be lots of other things in his pockets. That's right. I hope he doesn't jump overboard in his fright. It's lucky that we warned these other staterooms. It made a hellish row. You better go and look for him as soon as we get this thing out of the way."
But it was easier to look for Mr. Nielsen than to find him. The steward ransacked the ship for 3/4 of an hour, and he began to fear that the worst had happened. He was peering round anxiously on the boat deck when he heard an explosive cough somewhere over his head. He looked up into the rigging as if he expected to find Mr. Nielsen in the crosstrees, but nobody was to be seen except the watch in the crow's nest, dark against the stars.
"Mr. Nielsen," he called. "Mr. Nielsen!"
"Are you calling me?"
a hoarse voice replied. It seemed to come out of the air, above and behind the steward. He turned with a start, and a moment later he beheld the head of Mr. Nielsen bristling above the thwarts of Number 6 boat. He had been sitting in the bottom of the boat to shelter himself from the wind, and some symbolistic puck had made him fasten his court jacket round his pyjamas very firmly but upside down, so that he certainly would have been drowned if he had been thrown into the water.
"It's all right, Mr. Nielsen," said the steward. "The danger's over."
"Have we torpedoed?"
The round-eyed visage with the bristling hair was looking more and more like Bismarck after a debauch of blood and iron, and it did not seem inclined to budge.
"No, sir. The shock damaged your room a little, but we must have left the enemy behind. You had a lucky escape, sir."
"My God, I should think so indeed. The ship is not damaged in any way."
"No, sir. There was a blaze in your room, and I'm afraid they had to throw all your things overboard. But the purser says he can rig you out in the morning, and we have another room ready for you."
"Then I will come down," said Mr. Nielsen,
and he did so. His bare feet paddled after the steward on the cold, wet deck. At the companionway, they met the shadowy figure of the captain.
"I'm afraid you've had an unpleasant upset, Mr. Nielsen," he said.
"Unpleasant? It was terrible, terrible. But you see, Captain, I was correct, and this is only the beginning, according to my information. I hope now you will take every precaution."
"They must have mistaken us for a British ship, Mr. Nielsen, I'm afraid. I'm having the ship lighted up so they can't mistake us again. You see, I've got a searchlight playing the Argentine flag aloft, and we've got the name of the ship in illuminated letters 3 feet high all along the hull. They could read it 10 miles away. Come and look."
Mr. Nielsen looked with deepening horror.
"But this is madness," he gurgled. "The Hispaniola is marked, I tell you, marked for complete destruction."
The captain shook his head with a smile of skepticism that withered Mr. Nielsen's last hope.
"Very well, then I shall prefer an inside cabin this time." "Yes, you don't get so much fresh air, of course, but I think it's better on the O. If we're torpedoed, we shall all go down together, but you're safer from gunfire in an inside room."
The unhappy figure in pyjamas followed the steward without another word. The captain watched him with a curious expression on his broad red face. He was not an unkindly man, and if this German in the cork jacket had not been so ready to let everybody else aboard drown, he might have felt the sympathy for him that most people feel toward the fat cowardice of Falstaff. But he thought of the women and children, and his heart hardened. As soon as Mr. Nielsen had gone below, the lights were turned off, and the ship went on her way like a shadow. The captain proceeded to send out some wireless messages of his own. In less than an hour, he received an answer, and almost immediately the ship's course was changed. It was a strange accident that nobody on board seemed to have any clothes that would fit Mr. Nielsen on the following day. He appeared at lunch in a very old suit, which the dapper little Mr. Pennyfeather had worn out in the bank. Mr. Nielsen was now a perfect illustration of the schooldays of Prince Blood and Iron, at some period when that awful effigy had outgrown his father's pocket and burst most of his buttons. But his face was so haggard and grey that even the women pitied him. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the captain asked him to come up to the bridge and began to put him out of his misery.
"Mr. Nielsen," he said, "I'm afraid you've had a very anxious voyage, and though it's very unusual, I think in the circumstances it's only fair to put you on another ship if you prefer it. You'll have all your chance this evening.
You see those little smudges of smoke out yonder? Those are some British patrol boats, and if you wish, I'm sure I can get them to take you off and land you in Plymouth. There's a statue of Sir Francis Drake on Plymouth, though. You ought to see it. What do you think?
Mr. Nielsen stared at him. Two big tears of gratitude rolled down his cheeks.
I shall be most grateful, he murmured. They're wonderful little beggars, those patrol boats, the captain continued. Always on the side of the angels, as you said so feelingly at the concert. They're the police of the seas. They guide and guard us all, neutrals as well. They sweep up the mines, they warn us, they pilot us, they pick us up when we're drowning, and, as you said, they give us hot coffee. In fact, these little patrol boats are doing the work of civilization. Probably you don't like the British very much in Sweden, but... I have no national prejudices, Mr. Nielsen said hastily. I shall indeed be most grateful. Very well, then, said the captain. We'll let him know.
At 6:30, two of the patrol boats were alongside. They were the old Robin Gray and the Ruth, and they seemed to be in high feather over some recent success. Mr. Nielsen was mystified again when he came on deck, for he could have sworn that he saw something uncommonly like his brass-bound trunk disappearing into the hold of the old Robin Gray. He was puzzled also by the tail end of the lively conversation that was taking place between Mr. Pugh and the absurdly young naval officer with the lisp who was in command of the patrols. "Oh, no, I'm afraid we don't use the dungeons in the tower," said that slender youth, while Mr. Pugh, entirely feminine and smiling like a morning glory now, noted all the details of his peaked cap and the gold stripes on his sleeve. "We put them in the country houses and feed them like fighting cocks and give them flower gardens to walk in." He turned to Captain Abbey joyously and lisped over Mr. Nielsen's head. "That was a corking message of yours, Captain. I believe we got three of them right in the course you would have been taking today. You'll hear from the Admiralty about this, you know. It was magnificent. Goodbye." He saluted smartly, and taking Mr. Nielsen tightly by the arm, helped him down to the deck of the Ruth.
"Goodbye and good luck," called Captain Abbey.
He beamed over the bulwarks of the Hispaniola like a large red harvest moon through the thin mist that began to drift between them. "Goodbye, Mr. Nielsen," called Mr. and Mrs. Pennyfeather, waving frantically. "Goodbye, Herr Krauss," said Mr. Pugh, and the dainty malice in her voice pierced Mr. Nielsen like a Röntgen ray. But he recovered quickly, for he was of an elastic disposition. He was already looking forward to the home comforts which he now would be supplied by these idiotic British for the duration of the war. The young officer smiled and saluted Mr. Pugh again. He was a very ladylike young man, Mr. Nielsen had thought, and an obvious example of the degeneracy of England. But Mr. Nielsen's plump arm was still bruised by the steely grip with which that lean young hand had helped him aboard, so his conclusions were mixed. The engines of the Ruth were thumping now, and the Hispaniola was melting away over the smooth grey swell. They watched her for a minute or two, till she became spectral in the distance. Then the youthful young representative of the British Admiralty turned, like a thoughtful host, to his prisoner. "Would you like some tea?" he lisped sympathetically. "Your Uncle Hyacinth must have given you an awfully anxious time." Herr Krauss grunted inarticulately. He was looking like a very happy little Bismarck.